Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, I have to get something off my chest right out of the gate. We are, I'm afraid, well, possibly beyond, but certainly at the tipping point with respect to our border insecurity. We've, of course, had 3 years of Joe Biden wrecking Donald Trump's efforts to secure our southern border. And he's pretty well done it. I think it's no exaggeration to say it's more or less eliminated. And worse, the Biden team has been incentivizing people to come here by the 10 million or so, we're told. And Joe Biden seems utterly indifferent to the fact that among that 10 million illegals have been a large number of unaccompanied, military age, seemingly fit men from places like communist China and its allies and a whole bunch of jihadist nations. They've come here, I fear, not for economic opportunity and a better life. They've come here to destroy ours. And I mean ours as in yours and mine. And now we've had the Supreme Court of the United States say that the state of Texas, which has a good part of that southern border, of course, may not defend that border when the federal government refuses to do so. Now, this may sound hyperbolic, but I think it's no exaggeration. At best, this is a formula for a civil war in our country. At worst, well, I think it's akin to what the Roman Empire did, inviting in the barbarians who ultimately destroyed it. This is clearly an intolerable situation, and we all have hope that with his victory in New Hampshire yesterday, we will see Donald Trump returning to office and able to turn this around. But another year of this, ladies and gentlemen, could be absolutely devastating. So we need action now, and unfortunately it seems not to be forthcoming from the United States Senate, and therefore not from the United States Congress. So we need your help on this. We need you to let people like James Lankford know that you are not satisfied with the idea that we're going to increase amnesty opportunities and basically further incentivize people to come. Oh, maybe only 5,000 a day. But that's the current plan, ladies and gentlemen. This is clearly intolerable under these circumstances. There seems to be a chance that the Supreme Court may yet, on the merits of the case, decide differently than they did in this preliminary ruling. But we are in serious trouble on the border. And I think you all know that. And we're going to talk more about it in the days ahead and see what we can do to further energize a course correction. Well, that sort of sets up the conversation we're looking forward to having with one of our favorite guests, Bill Walton. Bill is, of course, the host of The Bill Walton Show, a terrific television podcast. He's also a man of considerable experience in matters that we are very interested in here, notably as Master of the Universe, once upon a time on Wall Street with Allied Capital, also as a leader of our conservative movement at the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very proud to be a member. Bill is a guy that we turn to particularly for matters involving finance. And we're going to be talking about that with him extensively today. But Bill, first, just a word on this situation with the border. Am I overstating the problem as you see it?
No. The border is wide open. And we've seen, by some accounts, some 15, 20,000 Chinese nationals come across the border. All of military age. And as we've talked about before, the Chinese Communist Party doesn't let people out of its country willy-nilly. And yeah. So if they're coming here, they're certainly coming here to embed themselves in the United States. And of course, once mm-hmm. they're in across the border, we have no idea where they go. Yeah. And of course, the Biden administration has failed to track things like bioweapons labs in the United States, and those are right. seemingly easier to find than individual people. So we've abandoned our national security at the southern border, and all the other talk of Biden administration about national security becomes a joke when you consider that fact.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that biolab business is exceedingly alarming because, as our friend Mike Gallagher of the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party has pointed out, there are almost certainly more of these labs. And if those labs get married up with people who, by the way, not only sort of fit a certain profile, but they don't even conceal the fact that, you know, they're wearing closely cropped hair and some of them have tattoos of the Chinese special forces, and, you know, they are moving in units, it seems, groups at least, they're carrying similar backpacks. It's a formula for a catastrophic attack upon our country using biological weapons, I'm afraid.
Well, and you think about a bioweapons lab and you think of billions of dollars of investments and all sorts of sophisticated technology. Well, this was in a warehouse.
And the one at Reedley, California that we found.
The one in California is in a warehouse, and the level of sophistication technology involved with this was not high. Mm-hmm. And so it makes the barriers to setting these things up quite low. All you've got to do is sneak into the country the necessary ingredients, and presto, you've got a bioweapons lab. So this is of grave concern, and I don't think Biden's Homeland Security people are tracking this even slightly.
Yeah, I was just going to say that you know, you may not even have to sneak them into the country. You may be able to buy them if you know what you're doing. But this is a key point that we're talking about a capacity to execute on a plan that, as we document in our book, The Indictment, to which you have contributed, Bill, with your help on our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars, the general who was the defense minister of China 20 years ago told a secret conclave of party apparatchiks, I believe, that the plan that had been instigated by the then general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party early in the 1990s, Deng Xiaoping, was to use the biological warfare program, which China's not supposed to have, by the way, to depopulate the United States so it could be colonized by China. And this is, if true, it certainly gives you a sense that maybe there was something going on when they attacked us with biological weapons, kind of at least a dress rehearsal with COVID-19. But this could be on a whole different order if those pathogens that are in the Reedley lab, for example, or in others that could be married up with these forces and disseminated in a much more professional way, not just having some granny from Wuhan coughing on your face, you know, and giving you exposure to that disease. So this is a major problem. And it's just stunning what you alluded to, Bill, last point, that the government under Joe Biden seems completely indifferent to all of this.
Well, to have a government that wants to protect its people is a government we do not have with the Biden administration. And
amen.
They still persist in seeing climate change as the biggest single threat the United States faces, and that is flat wrong. And right behind it is an inability, is our that we haven't ramped up the DEI agenda fast enough. And so you see spectacles of Janet Ramayan, who our commerce secretary, I don't think I've got her last name.
Raimondo,
Yeah, and Janet Yellen going over there trying to make deals with the Chinese, and they don't see us as in a war with them whatsoever. And so you've got to have an administration that sees the danger. They don't. And I'm a line of action guy, and the only line of action here is to get a new administration who wants to protect Americans.
Amen to that. We just can't get it fast enough, unfortunately. Bill, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you about another aspect of this colonization idea that might help explain what's up with this so-called natural asset company business. We'll talk about that and more with Bill Walton right after this. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Just when you thought the crisis at America's southern border could not get worse,
It has. 3 years of Team Biden's dismantling of the Trump administration's efforts to secure that frontier have essentially eliminated it. Worse, Joe Biden has further incentivized people from all over the world to come here with free stuff and facilitated entry. He has also been indifferent to the huge percentage of the 10 million or so who have entered illegally that are unaccompanied, military-aged men, many of them likely from Communist China's armed forces and its allies, or jihadist nations. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled Texas can't defend its border when the federal government won't. At best, that's an invitation to civil war. At worst, the justices have sealed the fate of a nation that, like the Roman Empire, welcomed in the barbarians who destroyed it. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We've got Bill Walton with us. I'm very pleased to say the host of The Bill Walton Show. I strongly commend to you. It's excellent contact week upon week. Bill is drilling down with guests according. Sometimes he has even me on, and we talk about these things at greater length, and it's really important to view it. Bill, I just wanted to come back to this idea that the Chinese Communist Party may have in mind eliminating the current inhabitants of this country, possibly through biological weapons, which has the advantage, of course, of leaving intact all of the infrastructure. You know, we used to say about the neutron bomb, not we, but its critics, it would kill all the people but save all the buildings. Well, biological weapons do that, of course, as well. And in this case, I want to tie in something that you were extremely helpful with back when we were fearful that we were hurtling towards an imminent adoption of something called a rule at the Securities and Exchange Commission governing a new class of publicly traded companies called natural asset companies. And I just would like to ask you to think about this in the context of if you were the Chinese and you wanted to take over this country and all of its magnificent bounty, including its natural resources, more or less intact so that you could exploit them when you run the place. A natural asset company agenda would fit nicely into that, would it not?
Well, let's talk about what they're trying to do here. There's something they've defined as ecosystem services, and it's the accounting for it's embedded on the United Nations website. And I've gone at that three or four times, and Even this accounting major can't figure out what they're doing. And you listen to their webinars, they really haven't got it figured out either. But they do know that whatever the value is, that nature provides us many things without cost. They call them ecosystem services, as I mentioned. And they're not fully captured in cost-benefit analysis. Well, as part of the Biden administration's whole-of-government agenda for to arrest climate change, they're working to have every agency work on something installing accounting for our natural ecological services in their budgets. And they've got real people involved in this, Frank. The Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, called ORIA, which it does under Trump, was helping to reduce regulation. Under Biden, it's helping to increase regulation. Also, the Office of Management and Budget, and they're doing this with the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and they've rolled out a paper on this as to how they want to implement across agencies. And the deeper purpose here, Frank, is to put a value on assets. The federal government owns about 40% of the land in the United States, and if they can somehow magically transform the value of this into its value for ecosystem services, It could be worth, as we talked about last time, trillions of, tens of trillions, hundreds of trillions of dollars.
Quadrillions. Why stop at trillions? Let's go to quadrillions.
Yeah, I feel like we're in a bad Austin Powers movie.
Mini me.
But so if you think about our $33 trillion debt, well, that pales in significance to the value of ecological ecosystem services. So there's an agenda here.
So we can print more money, value. Right?
More money. And but the other thing is to take productive land out of use. And that gets back to your point about China. And what we saw that we successfully killed, at least this particular version of the monster, were the creation of so-called natural asset companies, would be essentially a pool of capital to buy up the rights to put lands into disuse and for no productive human uses like agriculture, mining, oil, or even recreational
timber,
uses.
Yeah.
So that would
and the idea was that, as I understand it, you know, sovereign wealth from China and Russia and
Saudi Arabia, Iran,
could go in.
Even Russia has accumulated a fair amount of capital, so the vehicle to buy up these assets would be there and available. Well, that got stopped. Enormous pressure, blowback from states' attorney generals, from
treasures,
all sorts of private agencies, regular Margaret Byfield, who runs a shop to protect the private land use in America. And so that has stopped. The New York Stock Exchange, the SEC have shut that down, but that hasn't really stopped the idea. Mm. You don't need a New York Stock Exchange company to do this. We've got $1 trillion private equity business in the United States, maybe $2 trillion, and there are lots of pools of capital that could be made available for this. But what has to make it work is how do you account for these ecosystem services? And that's what the Biden administration is doing throughout all of its agencies. And they're conducting workshops as we speak with hundreds, if not thousands, of people trying to figure out how to make this happen. And if it does make it happen, it's going to create a quote, asset that will threaten the development of all of the land in the United States, and as you point out, make it available to put in disuse by people who don't like us.
And who want to have it for their use, possibly. Bill, the other piece of this that I think is really important is that John Kerry, who I guess is hanging up his spurs as the energies or green energies are, I should say, so he could go campaign for Joe Biden, is has been on record saying that one of the things that they're dead set on doing is making their whole green agenda irreversible. And what you've just described is a kind of workaround on this New York Stock Exchange setback. Which would be compounded if, as I understand it from Margaret and others, the federal government is poised to start basically letting these companies manage vast swaths of federal land and waters and air and the like. And so this is a real deal, a real no drill, as they say, and one that we have to stop in all of its aspects, I think. But Bill, before we lose you for this program, I did want to just very quickly take stock on another aspect of what's going on with the Chinese. As we talk, they are having some serious churning in their own stock markets. Not clear that they're going to have as much capital as they might otherwise, but tell us a little bit about what's happening there and why, and what the Chinese are doing to try to stabilize the situation, and whether you think they will.
Well, as you and I have talked over the course of the last year, what President Xi of China has been doing is essentially making the Chinese equity market and all other forms of investment in China uninvestable, very tough for outside investors to come in and successfully invest. And more importantly, even if you can get in, you can't get out. So liquidating your investments in China is almost an impossibility. Investors have finally woken up to that. And the equity markets in Hong Kong and the other Chinese markets have been in free fall for the last several months, continuing into this year. And they're down, by some accounts, 10, 15, 20%. Now, the question is, do the Chinese really care about this? And I'm not sure they do, because compared to the United States.
When you say the Chinese, you mean the government of China, not
Chinese Communist the Party
investors,
no, but even the Chinese people, Frank, because only 15% of Chinese have any kind of stake in the equity markets. Their typical investment vehicles have been
real estate
deposits or real estate or gold, and by comparison, almost 70% of Americans have some sort of stake in the stock market. And the Federal Reserve, and it's within its not so hidden agenda, really manages our money to keep the stock market vibrant, which is why wealthy people are happy and everybody else isn't with the Fed's inflation. But you're coming back to China. China's really been managing its bond market, and the Chinese bond and the Chinese currency have been managed for stability. It's like the good old days of the Bundesbank in Germany. And while the Chinese seem to be content, Chinese Communist Party seem to be content to let the equity markets go into a free fall, they've been protecting the value of their bonds assiduously. And moreover, Frank, China's still running the largest trade surplus in history, $70-80 billion a month.
And you can float a lot of boats with that. Bill, we are out of time. This is a topic to which we will return, the Chinese bonds and what it means for us. God bless you, my friend. Thank you for the time today. We'll look forward to our next visit. Keep up the great work with the Bill Walton Show, and stay well. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special and warm welcome to our friend and colleague Grant Newsom, retired Colonel, United States Marine Corps, a former Foreign Service officer to boot, as well as a successful entrepreneur and businessman in the Western Pacific. Grant is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, I'm very proud to say, and the author of a terrific and extremely timely new book, When China Attacks, a warning to America. Colonel, it's great to have you back as always, sir. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here, Frank.
Let me ask you, for starters, I was speaking in the previous segment with Bill Walton about this decision of the Supreme Court to basically tell the Texans that they have to just suck it up and let people in because that's the federal government's job. Again, there may yet be some further iterations of this, but for the moment, it looks as though the feds are going to be facilitating still further the transit of people across that southern border. And I've spoken with you about this before, Grant, but I'd like your sort of current assessment of all of this in light of the insertion by the Chinese Communist Party of what looked like a lot of People's Liberation Army personnel. What do you make of our border insecurity at the moment, sir, especially in that backdrop?
Well, I'd say that of all the things that Team Biden have done to hurt the United States, this is probably the biggest one. We cannot survive this. But what it demonstrates actually is just absolute contempt for American citizens, contempt for American laws, just everything. I'd say that the just contempt is breathtaking. In terms of the issue of Chinese getting across, and these are particularly, as you've noted, these are single men of military age who have actually come prepared to pass the not even minimal vetting that they get They're identically equipped. They have the same answers. But as noted, these are not just your run-of-the-mill immigrants, or illegal immigrants is a better way to put it. And given the obligation they have to the Chinese state, you can bet that Chinese state security in the PLA have at least some of them already sort of online, on the hook to use for military operations. And they are being allowed across, escorted across, sent on their way with no idea of who they are, where they are going. And this is a subset of just an effort really to destroy America as we have known it.
Yeah, quite possibly in this case, literally to destroy it, not simply to, you know, fundamentally transform it, as they say.
Well, that's and right.
On your point, and it's important to emphasize this when you talk about the contempt for the American people. This report that back in April of last year, the Customs and Border Patrol senior folks were told to streamline the processing of these Chinese nationals, to reduce the number of questions and the amount of time from 40 and 4 hours to minutes. And as you say, the answers are all, you know, of the five questions that they're asked, all canned and recited on command. This is a national security crisis of the first order, especially as we've talked about and we did with Bill, the possibility that, among other things, some of these guys may be marrying up with bio labs that the Chinese have in some number here beyond the one that we found in Reedley, California. So I so appreciate your calibration on this, Colonel. You've got a military man's eye and a clarity about it that is absolutely imperative. And as Bill Walton said, you know, we need a course correction on this right quick, especially, I think, the rounding up of those that we can find and their expulsion, as well as, of course, looking for those labs, something I don't think the Federal Bureau of Investigations is actually doing at the moment. Let me turn to another topic, if I may. We have been discussing, you and I, a bit over the past year or two, the Chinese penetration of other parts of our hemisphere. And I was briefed the other day that the Chinese have gotten this massive port in a place called Chancay, Peru, where, as you've observed, sir, they're seemingly designing the thing to be able to accommodate Chinese carrier battle groups, not just large commercial vessels. They're going to celebrate the inauguration of this thing, I'm told, at the next APEC summit there in Peru. And I heard that there's an announcement that a facility that's seven times larger is going to be built in the surroundings of the second largest city in Peru. What does all of this portend, in your professional judgment, about, well, not just their commercial penetration of Latin America, but their designs on the place and on us as well?
Oh, it's a systematic effort to lay the infrastructure for the People's Liberation Army, Navy in particular, but Air Force too, to operate freely in the hemisphere and ultimately to basically surround the United States. This is very much viewed as a longer-term effort to isolate and ultimately dominate the United States. And it's not just Latin America, it's every part of the world. You have this commercial port airfield infrastructure being put in place.
Mm-hmm. And I gather it's inherently dual use, as they say, so they can justify it on commercial grounds. And this is not just ports, of course, this is airfields, as you say, this is also rail networks and roadways and so on that they've been busily building out in Africa and Asia, some places in Latin, a lot of places in Latin America. In fact, one of the things that was really stunning when we did our study at what we called our Captive Nations Coalition of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which you're a very important member, Colonel, 147, as I recall, nations have bought into this, or more to the point, been bought into this Belt and Road Initiative. And that's a lot of power projection, is it not? Let me turn finally, Colonel, you live up in the neighborhood of the Korean Peninsula from your base up in Japan. One of the things that has been, brooded for some time, both by the North Korean regime, of course, but also some of its fellow travelers, shall we say, in South Korea, yes, but also even here, is the idea that what we need is an armistice and a formal end to the war between the United States and South Korea on the one hand, and I guess the United Nations for that matter, but also the North Koreans, of course. And one of the upshots of that, as you've talked about on this program and elsewhere, is that it might have an impact on our presence and ability to help defend South Korea. Talk a little about all that in the context of what we're seeing the North Koreans doing now. I personally think it's probably another ripe opportunity for the strategic arson that Xi Jinping has been engaged in. But I'm interested in your thoughts both about what's happening there at the moment and what might have happened had we actually gone down that road of so-called armistice.
Oh, if we had declared an armistice as really Beijing's proxies in the United States and a few on Capitol Hill were calling for and continue to call for, you'll have war in short order. You will undercut the basis for American troops being in South Korea. And as soon as they are pulled out or greatly reduced, you'll have a fight. And that has always been the case. The nature of the Kim family criminal organization hasn't changed. Their objectives haven't changed, and that is to dominate the Korean Peninsula and control the Korean Peninsula and snuff out freedom in South Korea. Unfortunately, they've had their proxies, their front men in South Korea, who on several occasions have actually run the country. It's just been through good fortune they have been voted out of office. They may come back.
Amen.
But there's a direct connection. Take out U.S. troops, as would happen if you declare an armistice. And you'll have war.
Yeah. It sounds as though that you may have war, even if those troops are still there. Colonel, there was, I think, some sort of amendment to the Constitution of North Korea, for whatever that's worth. But it was a pretty strong signal that the Kim Jong-un version of the Kim dynasty is good to go. Is that how you see it at the moment? That if, for example, Xi Jinping says, I want you guys to go further distract the United States, further deplete its resources defending South Korea, that it will be war even with our troops on the ground?
Almost certainly. I think you'll get some sort of a move by the North Koreans if China decides to make its move elsewhere. That is just guaranteed. And the move, it's hard to say, an all-out assault on South Korea, maybe not, but just fire a missile or two into Seoul would do the job nicely, or into Tokyo, or even maybe hit us in Guam. Just do something that's going to distract us, cause us to devote resources to the peninsula that could go to Taiwan.
Yeah. Speaking of those missiles, very quickly, Colonel, some of them are now capable of ranging the United States itself, not just, our allies and outcroppings in the Western Pacific. Do you countenance that as a possibility as well?
Oh, it could be. You're right. Their missile capabilities have just gradually improved and to the point where just about anywhere in America is in range as well. It's an engineering problem, and they've addressed it. We've allowed them to get away with it. We've allowed China to back them on this, help them with it, and we get what we deserve if we're this dumb.
Heaven help us, and I mean that literally. Thank you, Grant Newsom, for your time and your expertise. We're always delighted to have you with us. Come back, please, as soon as possible. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Just when you thought the crisis at America's southern border could not get worse, it has. 3 years of Team Biden's dismantling of the Trump administration's efforts to secure that frontier have essentially eliminated it. Worse, Joe Biden has further incentivized people from all over the world to come here with free stuff and facilitated entry. He has also been indifferent to the huge percentage of the 10 million or so who have entered illegally that are unaccompanied, military-aged men, many of them likely from Communist China's armed forces and its allies, or jihadist nations. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled Texas can't defend its border when the federal government won't. At best, that's an invitation to civil war. At worst, the justices have sealed the fate of a nation that, like the Roman Empire, welcomed in the barbarians who destroyed it. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased always to be able to say a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Itamar Marcus. He is the founder and president of a marvelous organization based in Israel, Palestinian Media Watch. And its unique role for, well, a couple of decades now, I believe, has been to actually monitor what the Palestinians are saying. What a concept. To make book, really, for the rest of us, with translations and analysis and commentary, of course, about the true stance of the Palestinians, what they're saying, particularly to their own people in Arabic, whether this is Hamas or even the professed Partners for Peace of Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and what Itamar's research has documented amply, for any wish to take it aboard, is that there is no Palestinian leadership anywhere that is genuinely a partner for peace for Israel. And we're going to explore with him the implications of that for both Israel, of course, in the present moment, and for, I believe, our vital interests in the region as well. Itamar, welcome back to Securing America. It's so good to have you with us always.
Thank you very much, Frank. Great to be with you again.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you, if I can, about the purported divisions between Hamas on the one hand and Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority on the other. And this is not a topic we've missed visiting with you about in the past, but just your current sort of status report on this. Have we seen, with the growing insistence of the United States government that Israel has to essentially turn over, reward the Palestinians for October 7th by giving them a state, that there's somebody to turn it over to who would be not just another threat to Israel, perhaps under a different banner?
Yes. First of all, the Palestinian Authority, in terms of its ideology, is almost identical to the to Hamas as it relates to Israel. Hamas says it's a religious war for Allah to destroy Israel. PA, Fatah, say it's a religious war. Hamas say it's a religious war against Jews to exterminate the Jews. The PA, Fatah, say it's a religious war to exterminate the Jews. So the fact that there are differences in between those two extreme opinions, there are differences about how we get there between the Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. But they don't disagree about the final goal. That's the first thing. Now, right now, we have a unique situation where they each need each other. Now, we know that for years there's been a split and a civil war and hatred between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Right now, they both need each other, and I'll explain exactly why. The Palestinian Authority has no support of the population anymore. Recent polls show anywhere between 10 and 15% supporting them, everybody else supporting Hamas. the terror organization. So they have no support of the people. They can't possibly rule. Hamas can't rule because the international community won't give funding to any organization, any Palestinian authority that's run by Hamas. So what are they planning? They're planning a symbiotic relationship, literally, where the face of the Palestinian Authority for the international community is going to be the Palestinian Authority, but the Hamas are the ones who are going to join and unite with them in order to bring along the 80% of population of the Palestinians who support Hamas. Right. And the international community is going to do what they've done for the last more than three decades with the Palestinian Authority, is they're going to look away and pretend that they don't see that their money is going into the pockets of Hamas.
Wow. This is a chilling prospect, and obviously a temporary arrangement. It's not a permanent deal. They would almost certainly in due course remove the vestiges of the Palestinian Authority, I imagine the Hamas guys. But I did want to come back to something that you said that kind of surprised me, because we've been encouraged to believe that there is a difference between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority with respect to Hamas being clearly religious and the PA being a more secular Palestinian entity. And yet you say, really, they're on the same page with respect to essentially Sharia supremacism and its agenda of conquest of the Jews, of course, but also the rest of us as well. No?
Yes, we've heard this many times from the Palestinian Authority. We've heard it from we've heard it from the top religious figures. We've heard it from political figures who are also religious. The big difference is Hamas is so intensely religious, first and foremost, that they're not willing to tell the international community the lies that the Palestinian Authority does. They're not willing to lie and say, we'll accept Israel's existence, and then later come back and fight. The PA has told its people many times that they, in the interest of politics, the Quran allows people to lie in the interest of politics. We've heard this from the PA. We've heard from the Palestinian Authority leadership going back to Yasser Arafat and up until today, Mahmoud al-Abbas, who is Abbas's right-hand man and advisor, and they both said that the agreement, any agreements with Israel, is based on Muhammad's Hudaybiyah agreement. And I just have to point out what that is. Hudaybiyah agreement was signed in the city of Hudaybiyah between Muhammad's army and the Quraysh tribe of Mecca. It was supposed to be a 10-year peace agreement. 2 years later, when Muhammad was strong enough, he came in and conquered Mecca. Now, we have the PA leadership saying, this is our model for Oslo. That's what it's all about. We're too weak to defeat Israel today. Therefore, we will sign this agreement like Hudaybiyah. When we're strong enough, we will then continue to destroy them. And everyone knows, by the way, that the 67 borders, that 67 ceasefire lines that the world wants us to go back to, Israel cannot survive them. It's as simple as that.
Right, right. And that would be especially so if Iranian-backed militants, jihadis, whatever you want to call them, ran the place, both from Gaza as well as from the so-called West Bank. We have to take a short break, Itamar, and I just want to say thank you for both what you've just said and the clarity that you've brought to it, but also documenting it with your extensive work on what the Palestinian of the PA stripe are actually saying to their own people, as opposed to what they want the rest of the world to understand. We'll be right back with more with Itamar Marcus. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're visiting with one of the smartest guys I know, most especially when it comes to matters involving the state of Israel and its security, vis-a-vis particularly the Palestinian entities that are arrayed against Israel, that make no secret, really, of their desire to, well, as they say, drive the Jews from the river to the sea, meaning genocidally eliminating the state of Israel. The thing that has always worried me, Itamar, and I know it's something on your mind as well, is the help that these factions, whatever their differences, most often, I guess, the Palestinian Authority has been given by elements within Israel itself. Sometimes the government of Israel, sometimes, you know, the radical left, sometimes Arab factions, of course, in the parliament. But what we're seeing now, I fear, is a return to some of the profound divisions that were afflicting the Jewish state prior to October 7th, and that we were told in the aftermath of that horrific attack by the Palestinians, both, by the way, elements of Hamas, of course, but also the Palestinian Authority, were no more, that unity was now the order of the day in Israel. Everybody was pulling together. Question one, how accurate is that assessment that we're now seeing these fault lines, these fracture points developing in Israel again? And secondly, perhaps we could talk as well about what the Biden administration seems to be doing to exacerbate them.
Okay, first let's talk about the split in Israel today. The great problem that Israel has fighting this war, aside from the fact that Hamas is very well armed and that they're under, you know, 500 miles or so of tunnels they have underground and in a, what, a 30 mile long Gaza Strip, it's just unimaginable. But yes. So that in itself is an incredible challenge. But the big challenge is that in those tunnels are another 136 Israeli hostages, almost all of them alive. So that Israel cannot even, we're fighting with one hand behind our back, because even if we know where the Hamas leadership is underground, we can't destroy those tunnels because they're surrounding themselves with our hostages. So this is the first problem.
Human shields.
Hamas has used their own people for years as human shields, and now they're using about 120 or so Israelis, as live Israelis, as human shields. So this is Israel's first challenge. The second challenge is that there are people in Israel who are so anti-government, and I don't want to talk about the families. The families of the hostages just deserve our utmost sympathy. And if they go out and demonstrate out of frustration, I don't blame them at all. But what I'm seeing is there are clearly forces, and possibly giving them even the wrong advice and telling them to go out and demonstrate against the Israeli government, demanding of the Israeli government that they have a cheer that they're doing now. To release the people now. They have another one that says give in to all the Hamas demands, everything for everything. What they don't realize, and this is the tragedy here, they don't realize that Yahya Sinwar, head of Hamas, is sitting in his bunker surrounded by Israeli hostages, and he's laughing. They're publicizing it on their Telegram channels. We see all these videos. They're sitting there, and they're laughing at the Israelis, saying, okay, I don't have to compromise. I'm going to sit back here and wait for the pressure on the Israeli government to work. So what's happening is he is actually enabled to have more demands on Israel. Every time there's another demonstration in Israel to release the hostages now, they're actually making it, they make it harder to release the hostages because they're making Yahya Sinwar comfortable that Israelis will give in. And this is the great tragedy that's happening here. There's also a lot of left-wing press that I would say hates Netanyahu more than they care about the hostages. So they're willing to highlight all of these demonstrations against the government as if the government is at fault here, and the government's not at fault. Yeah. So that has a potential to split the country, and I'll tell you why. The soldiers are united. And when I talk about, so we're talking about 300,000 people who were drafted. I have two sons who are in the army right now, drafted. I have a son-in-law who's drafted. Many, many other relatives are drafted. And the whole country, all the soldiers are united. We have to be together. We have to support the united war effort. And so what's happening is you've got a fringe that has a lot of media support, manipulating the families to create the division in the country. And I'm hoping that the people are stronger than the, than that media and those divisive forces, and unity will hopefully prevail.
Amen. Unfortunately, there does seem to be this other factor in all of this, and that is, well, probably the international community, so-called, more generally, but specifically the Biden administration, which, as you know, Itamar, is under domestic pressure of its own, with its base, some of whom are very overtly pro-Hamas, many of whom seem to be increasingly anti-Israel. And we're told that one of the things that is manifesting now is pressure from Washington, as well as some of these factions, to hold elections immediately in the midst of this war, for the purpose, they think, of removing Benjamin Netanyahu. And oh, by the way, the obstacle that he has now represented in terms of their end state of creating this Palestinian, you know, state after the destruction of, well, of Gaza, if not of Hamas. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah. So, first of all, no one realistic is expecting Israel to have elections right now. Elections in Israel are incredibly divisive. They tear the country apart, and during a war, it would be absolutely impossible to have elections, and except for one fringe person in Israeli, you know, opposition, Yair Lapid, if I understood correctly, but I'm not even that. I'm not sure he can be serious. We're not going to have elections. On the other hand, I'm not sure that those reports are true, that the United States is encouraging that. I don't believe they're true. But what I do believe is true, the United States is definitely pushing Israel to put the Palestinian Authority back into power afterward. And this is something that we, the Israeli government, but I also say myself at Palestinian Media Watch, I'm trying to impress upon American officials that the Palestinian Authority is the source of the problem. They're the source of the power that Hamas has.
We have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you for joining us. Come back soon with updates, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.